Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, it's Lainey.
Hey, it's Savannah.
And welcome to Show Your Work, where we obsess about work.
I'm currently thinking about whether I should be adding more profanity to this podcast. We just learned that there's not maybe as much as we might have thought.
I can't fucking believe that.
Nice. Nicely done.
Are you still mad at me?
I mean...
Should we tell people why you're mad at me or why you were mad at me? By the time you listened to this a week ago...
Oh, you mean why? Oh, well, I'm mad at you right now immediately because you offered me some chips and then we're like, no, I'm just kidding. You can't have those chips. So there's that. But yes, I was mad at you the other night because you casually texted me and were like, yeah, whatever, text. Anyway, this is just an excuse to say I'm sitting here with Zadie Smith.
Okay, you make it sound like it was just me and Zadie Smith and nobody else.
So did you.
Zadie Smith gave a talk at TIFF. To kick off their books on film series. And she's kind of an E.M. Forster expert. And it was Room with a View.
Mm-hmm.
And so they play the movie and then she does... No, they do an intro where she does the intro with Eleanor Wachtel. And then they play the movie. And then she comes back on stage and she and Eleanor talk about the movie. Anyway, I texted you because I had to pee during the movie. Of course I did. And... I can't remember. No, I texted you back because you would text me about something else.
Gentle listeners, I'm rolling my eyes right now. Like, this could be a one-sentence story, but we have to relive the whole story.
I love her so much.
First of all, you didn't tell me you were going beforehand so that I could flail around and come with you.
I was asked last minute.
I could have bought a standing room ticket if such a thing existed.
It was sold out.
It was also actually so... It wasn't even secret. It wasn't even a press event that the public can't go to. It's just that I was on another planet and did not know that this exists.
Not going to lie. I knew it existed. Totally forgot about it. Didn't know. And then like 2 days before the event, Jess Allen, our friend, was like, oh, hey, I have an extra ticket. And I was like, oh, fuck, yeah. Anyway, so...
Here's the thing. Jess Allen could be forgiven for not calling me, but lest you think, oh, yeah, but Lainey's a really big Zadie Smith fan, ask me what my cat's name is. A poor, poor cat who is a whole story on her own. Ask me what my cat's name is. Both names, Zadie and Smith.
I believe we've mentioned that.
Just saying.
People know.
No, our... we've definitely not mentioned that.
We have fucking mentioned it. Face. We've totally mentioned it. I've written about the fact that you named your cat after Zadie Smith.
I barely acknowledge that I have a cat. Anyway,
I just wanted to say this, and the real reason I brought up Zadie Smith is that in the talk, they come back after the film, and Zadie and Eleanor Wachtel are sitting down, and they're talking about the film. And in their introduction to the film, or at least at the beginning of talking about it, before they get into the characters and before they get into the tension in the film.
One sentence.
I just want to say, and this is what I texted you, I wanted to say that she noticed beauty. She commented on the beauty of these actors. She was like, my God, Helena Bonham Carter was so beautiful. My God, Julian Sands. My God, they were all so beautiful. And the reason I brought it up, or I brought it up with you, is because I feel like right now we are at a time when, thank God, we are pointing out that a woman especially is more than just her looks. But sometimes we overreact and we sway so far in one direction that it becomes, but we can't mention person's looks, but we can't focus on that, or we can't at least make that observation. And I'm just saying that I appreciated that Zadie was able to make that observation, that the beauty of these actors was impressionable to her, mattered to her, made, you know, a difference to her.
You know what's interesting about that is that it's beauty to her, like, on screen, right? Like, you remember there used to be language about, like, the way, what kind of things did they say? You know, somebody who was an arresting presence on screen, or who was, like, it's not always about the most beautiful, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, that line about, like, oh, I know my angles, says yes. Every sort of model slash Instagram celebrity or whatever. I sometimes feel like when we talk about that sort of thing, oh my God, they were so beautiful. It's not really about sort of a, you know, a Western standard of beauty necessarily, as like those, oh my God, celluloid moments, for lack of a better word, that are so just like moments in time where you see somebody 25 feet high and you're like, like, I think that's amazing. I feel like that's okay to acknowledge. I grant that.
And that's Zadie Smith. Like, I mean, if Zadie says it's okay, to me, it's okay.
Well, it still would have been better if I'd been there. I would have told you if she really thought it was okay.
I'm telling you that that was her observation. Because then, oh, she made this. Then she went on. Okay, you're going to roll your eyes even more now. But then she went on to, like, they were just talking about British actors at this point. And she went on to tell this story about Hugh Grant. And that Hugh Grant apparently used to hang out in Oxfordshire. And she was like, oh, and back then, all he was known as like, the most beautiful guy in Oxford.
Right.
Have you heard that story before?
No, I don't think so, but I do sort of, I mean, I believe it. I really do like those stories, though, of people who cross over unexpectedly. Like, remember the one that made me roll my eyes so hard yesterday was Matthew Perry on the late night shows saying that he beat up Justin Trudeau. So, first of all, you know the little, like, news screen on your iPhone? There wasn't much going on in Toronto yesterday, I guess, because it was up there like six different times as a headline.
Matthew Perry kicked the prime minister's ass.
And he says that he was 10 at the time. And I immediately was like, and the prime minister was a zygote, I guess. Like, does it blow your mind that they're even able to be the same age, that they would be in the same educational institution?
Well, and that was the point, that, like, if you do the side-by-side in 2017, it's hard to believe, yeah, that they would have been in middle school or, what, elementary school?
Yeah, apparently they're 2 years apart. So if Perry was 10, as he claims, then Justin Trudeau was 8 years of age, placing this in 1979, by the way, if we're doing the math. I don't know. It still seems odd to me. Matthew Perry has had many, many years of living, and Justin Trudeau looks like a dewy-faced baby.
But we, and at the same time, Justin Trudeau, what's interesting too is that Justin Trudeau, as well-known as he, you think, ostensibly should be, in that middle time period of, like, his teenage years and even early 20s, we don't know what he was doing, really. Like, he was not that visible.
Let alone as an 8-year-old. No. And yeah. Matthew Perry only lived in Canada for, like, select hot minutes.
But so, we feel like we've known him longer just because every Thursday night for how long was Friends on?
10 years. But before that, he played somebody who was a tennis player who was about to kill himself, but for Brandon Walsh's intervention. On 90210, remember, you guys? He had really bad hair. I think the tennis playing he comes by honestly, though. Anyway,
to work. Mm-hmm. And I feel like the person we're going to kick off the show with is the last person I thought would make it on to show your work, let alone be in the number one spot. I just, first, for many reasons, one of them being you and I don't get super royal together.
No, in fact, no.
Like, you're not the one that I, like, royally bond with. That would be our friend Lorella. Lorella and I do lots of royal talk together.
Laura,
our other friend Laura cares about royals. But you and I don't really go deep diving into royal shit. And yet you were the one who texted me, I think it was like, today's Friday, so maybe Wednesday, out of the blue saying, you know, I wouldn't mind putting William, Prince William, in the podcast this week. And I was like, Jesus, wow, she's right. He should be in the podcast this week. But
don't sound so surprised that I'm right.
No, but, like, again, it's surprising to me that Prince William is making it onto Show Your Work. But here we are, Prince William.
So, okay, So let's back it up. How many, because I do, I actually know my royals quite well and I'm aware, but you're right. I find it, I don't know what, kind of pointless to talk about them sometimes because there's no reaction. If we talk about a celebrity and something that they've done, they will come out and counteract it for better or for worse. And I feel like royal stuff goes into a vacuum.
Yeah.
You say, that's a weird ass hat, Princess Beatrice. And she says, see you in 7 years. Like nothing. Yeah. There's no anything. So sometimes it feels pointless to me. But this week, on the heels of the dancing in what, the ski club scandal, where was he?
In, like it's Switzerland. The sure. name of the town is Verbier, V-E-R-B-I-E-R. Verbier?
Sure.
Anyway, yes. So just a quick recap. Commonwealth Day is a major event on the royal calendar. The Queen.
When is that?
That was this year. It was Monday, March 13th.
Okay.
And it's a service. The Queen was there. Prince Charles was there. The uncles were there.
What's
Andrew
there?
Edward.
Where were they? What were they
at
doing?
A service at Westminster Abbey.
Okay, fine.
And Prince Harry was there. So the senior royals were all represented with the exception of Prince William. And we subsequently found out that he was on holiday in Switzerland skiing with his boys. And photos were taken of him having beers, après-ski, high-fiving blonde models. And then later, video emerged of him dancing badly at a nightclub. Basically, what people are saying is that he's work shy. And here is the most egregious example of it. Because his work commitments, when he shows up to represent the family, those are significantly less in frequency than most members of his family. And considering he is really the second in line to the throne, what is it? Do you call it that?
Yeah, it is.
He's like the first runner-up?
Yeah. Well, he's the runner-up of the runner-up.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. First of all, we're here to talk about work, but I really feel like the scandal, such as it was, overtook things. So I saw that video in which he touches a model's hip or holds up. God, I did not care. Like, would you care? Did you care?
I care, but I think I care because with these people and with this family, there's a different set of standards and expectations.
And we're going to get there. But I'm talking about from the story that's being touted, from the perspective of your husband who was off skiing with his boys.
Sure. If he was whatever, Jay-Z, I wouldn't give a shit.
Well, what if he was your husband? If there was video that came out of him touching somebody's hip, is that, am I desensitized? I don't care.
Are you in isolation? Like touching someone's hip on a boys' trip when he was supposed to be or when he should have been with his family?
We'll get to the work stuff. I just want to dispense, first of all, with the...
How innocent in isolation that move was. Hey, it's loud in the club. He leans over to hear somebody talking. He touches her on the hip. Isolation, sure.
Yeah, no, but I'm asking you.
Innocent.
I'm asking you. Would you really have an issue with that? Perhaps I am, as a wife, as a person, perhaps I am being too generous about tall people, but if you are tall and drunk, you lose your balance. He was hanging on to her as much for balance as for flirtation or attraction. Tall people, back me up.
I feel like that's generous, but I'm not going to debate you on height right now.
And now we get to the work. So one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about this with you is because I wanted you to lay out for us, there's that term work shy, but I wanted you to lay out for us what is expected of him at this point. So he's second in line to the throne, which means, I don't know what the life expectancy is of Prince Charles, but what, it's still 25 years away, let's say?
Well, I mean, look, you want to get into the royal politics. There are a lot of people who believe that the queen is like hanging on. She is just like, I am going to live and live and live. My mother lived to be what, like 100? I'm going to live and live and live as long as I can so that my firstborn is not going to be the one. And I'd rather, like, there are many people who believe that theory.
Like, you mean she's going to outlive Charles? Like, let's call or it if we're calling it.
Live so long that his
reign
will really be insignificant, and that it will really be William who is going to assume the throne. Is that how you say it? Assume the throne.
It's a literal throne. But how is she going to do that short of, like, assassination? I don't know. If I'm assassinated tonight, it's because I just suggested there was a plot afoot in the royal family. There was that article this week, that great article about what will happen when the queen dies.
In The Guardian?
Yeah. Good, a really good read. But, okay, he's at least, put it another way, he's two deaths away from the throne. What is he supposed to be doing? What's the work supposed to look like at this point?
Well, this is really interesting because I'm going to throw work in combination with sibling. So at this point, Harry is, I don't know, fifth in line now because of the two babies. So it's Charles, William, George, Charlotte, Harry.
That's right.
That's five.
That's right.
So to me, it's, I get what you're saying. Like, what's he supposed to do? He's two deaths away. And yet there's Prince Harry out. I think this week he worked 6 days in a row, and last year and the year before he outworked his brother.
Okay, but
so he doesn't have any hope of getting there.
No, but I'm asking, like, what's the requirement? At what point? I know they're supposed to do some military service after school, but beyond that, what are they supposed to spend their days on? What does work look like for Prince Andrew? How much? I don't know what was laid out for them, and so I don't know why it's so piecemeal to figure out what it is they're doing. And, of course, the accusation has been leveled at Kate, too, right? Not just Will?
It has been leveled at her. I'm okay with not leveling it at her because, listen, I've never been a mother. I'm not raising two kids, but you know what? She has said that her priority is her children. He has said that he wants to represent his family, but that he didn't want to start his official royal duties until he was done at his other job, which is like flying rescue helicopters.
Right. But obviously, I think he would be easily accounted for if he was doing that, right?
Well, the news has come out once again that his flying rescue helicopter schedule is actually like barely better than part-time. It's not... So that's why a lot of these members of the British press are like, what do? When you're like 90 plus whatever grandpa and your 90 almost one grandma are like hustling it out there. Like those two oldies are like getting up and doing and pounding the pavement and shaking those hands.
Okay, but let's really be real here. If you are Prince Philip and Elizabeth, you have, and they're both, to put it in your very eloquent terms, oldies. they've experienced everything life has to offer. Like, it's entirely possible that they just go home and lie in their, like, cryogenic tubes.
Oh my God, she day drinks. Like, her first drink is at noon. She has her first drink at lunch.
I mean, that's entirely acceptable.
Apparently her mother, it wasn't that the story that her mother, like, drank a whole bottle of gin every day?
Okay.
I need to fact check this. Continue.
I mean, she lived to 100 and whatever, so, you know, maybe
know.
Don't be sniffing at it. But I do ask seriously, and I continue to ask, because I know that underneath all these things, there's, like, issues of the monarchy being important to the British people or not, and what happens if they decide that they don't care about them anymore, and
right.
all of these things. So talking about all this, I really want to know what, you know, what do ascending millennials think Prince William should be doing all day? What is the worth of going to shit like Commonwealth Day that, you know, I don't know if half the UK knows it exists to be annoyed that he was there or not. Like, part of the conversation here is, okay, the royals exist, but does anybody care? And I say this with all earnestness. I almost wonder if they're doing their best work when they are tabloid fodder. And I'm not trying, you know, they're essentially movie stars. I'm not sure that the goodwill that they impart to the British people by showing up and waving is going to hang on through the next generation. So I have some, if not sympathy, I have some questions about whoever's giving him his marching orders.
I would be more inclined to be on side with that argument. Like, what is expected of them? Like, the fact that they exist, essentially, and step out once in a while and show up in the tabloids really is enough to generate the interest and the intrigue and to keep the family whatever. But I think the asterisk here is that their very livelihood is literally from the taxpayers.
Oh, 100%. Right? I get it. But I don't think – it used to be that the showing up and the waving was service, right? And like that would perk up the, you know, the downtrodden, war-torn. And I don't know if just being smiling icons is what the British populace wants out of their royals that are tax-supported going forward. And I don't know who you poll to ask, British populace, but I would love to know what they're supposed to be doing in order to revitalize the monarchy and keep going beyond, let's be honest, doing things like dating high-profile people and, you know, getting everybody excited over what weddings might ensue.
Oh my God, Harry's doing a great job.
This is my point.
With respect to Prince William, you referenced that article this week that was in The Guardian about London Bridge, which is the code name that they use.
Wasn't that the coolest part?
Yes. The code name that they use, of course you would think that was the coolest part, what they named the plan, the funeral plans for the Queen, and it's been set in place, or they've been adding to it, but they've been having regular meetings about this for years and years and years.
But like somebody's going to pick up the phone, call the Prime Minister at 3 a.m. and go, London Bridge, click.
It has fallen.
It's amazing.
Yes, London Bridge has fallen.
That's amazing.
And it's super James Bond, for sure. But within that article many times, I mean, I think the subtext of that article is that the role of the monarchy is not what it was when the Queen, you know, had her coronation.
And generations ago.
That's right. I think it's the article said that she's outlasted 12 U.S. presidents or yes. something like that. So, in fact, the world and the monarchy are quite unstable right now. Huh. There's that understatement. There's so much unpredictability. And so what this article argues is that the funeral and the ceremony and the planning and the spectacle that the world will see when, God forbid, Queen Elizabeth II passes is a way to reassert the value and the importance of the British monarchy to the British identity. So when I talked about Prince William on the blog, my point was he was supposed to be the reliable one, not the one who went to Vegas and cupped his balls and played pool and got his picture taken. He was the one who married the nice girl who did such a great job becoming the princess. He was the one who quickly had two kids. He was the one who was supposed to have it together. And suddenly, as she approaches her 91st birthday, the one she thought was, oh, he's the one who's going to do the good job, not my son who had the Camilla and the divorce and the tampon quote and whatever. He was the one I can count on to fulfill my legacy and to carry on. And suddenly, in just, you know, a few weeks' time or over time, we are hearing more and more about the one who was supposed to be reliable and dependable might not be that way.
Yeah, because no shit, because you have this obligation hanging over them for their entire lives with no fulfillment. No shit, they're going to get a little squirrely. As you were talking, I was trying to Google when Tampon Gate happened and what the comparison of ages were. I know that Prince Charles got married when he was, I think, 33 yeah. and Diana was 19, because that's super going to work. And William's what now, 36?
Not even. Like I would, 34 maybe?
Yeah, I'm saying, do not dangle the sword of Damocles over somebody's head for their entire life and then wonder why in the fourth decade they start to cut a wee bit loose.
Well, I get that 100%. His problem, or the problem with that argument, is that his grandmother has never wavered from her duty. Ever.
Okay.
Remember, like when she was a kid, she listened to bombs going off and like she lived in a city that was literally getting shelled every single night. Like, and that, I'm not arguing. I'm not saying you're wrong. I'm saying that the people who would criticize him That's what they would come back to you with. They would say, how hard is it for him?
But my thing is, I'm saying,
she's a woman.
All those people who are about to say that, gonna die. Prince William's contemporaries and the people who will be around when he assumes that throne some goddamn day don't care. They don't
care. You don't care.
I don't care, but I cannot imagine my contemporary of a certain age sitting in Cricklewood, London, home of Zadie Smith, and going like, I'm scandalized that he went to a nightclub.
I'm sorry, you don't think a 35-year-old Briton voted Brexit? Come on now. The Brexit voters were not over 50 or 60, Duana.
Okay, we can't.
You still have like our generation or even the millennial. Look at the, remember the girl who was interviewed and the next morning was like,
But Brexit is not royals. We can't be conflating these things. I'm talking about.
Oh, yes, you can. Because Brexit was very much a lot of people who were like, we want Britain to stay with what Britain is.
But let's
and
be.
That's what the Guardian article argued.
Okay. What they meant was we want Britain to stay white.
Uh-huh.
But I don't believe, and I do think we're kind of getting into murky territory, but I don't think it, I still don't think that that equates to ergo our weird figureheads that do nothing can never have fun. And I don't think anybody cares that the Queen never did anything, because let's be honest, everybody thinks the Queen, look, she is unchanging. Her hairstyle has been the same on our money since I was born.
Yes.
But like, we don't have the attention span for that shit
anymore.
And that's
the comfort, though. I think that because she was so unwavering and unchanging with the same hairstyle, that represented a stability. And then you have, who's coming up next? Are they going to live up to the same sense of stability?
I get it. I'm just saying, I believe people don't want stability anymore. We're from an Instagram generation. I hold my phone while I'm watching TV. I can't do one thing at once. I think people want a little more interest, a little more excitement, especially if these people are going to siphon from their taxes for the foreseeable future. So there, fixed it.
All right. Well, Duana is not that mad at Prince William. If you are mad at Prince William or if you have an alternate point of view, let us know.
Yeah, if you are delighted with the ongoing unchangingness of the monarchy, let me have it.
All right. Okay, we're going to go from... not real life, because I'm pretty sure we can agree that the royal life is not real life, to semi-real life.
I'm just saying, man, let them be real. Yes, go on.
Semi-real life, or at least a real life issue that we can discuss, which is Emily Blunt and John Krasinski. It was announced this week that he will be writing and directing a movie, and she will be starring in it. Is he starring in it too?
Yes, they're starring in it together.
It's called A Quiet Place.
Mm-hmm.
It will be the first time that they've worked together.
Mm-hmm.
And I pitched this to you for the podcast, mm-hmm. and you had a big reaction.
I sure did.
It was all caps over text. No, no. Yeah. So this is, they're not the first spouses in Hollywood to work together.
No, but it don't always go so well. I don't love it. I don't. I could be very wrong, and there are all kinds of reasons, which I will get into if we have the time and the, like, therapy couch space. But I don't know. I don't know if it's a good idea to go to work every day and work with your spouse all day. And I believe that those can be good working relationships. And then go home and complain about your day to the – but he was there all day. But it's a lot. And you know, if it was a big ensemble and they both happened to be in it, I think that might be a different story than what seems necessarily like they are co-stars, love interests, and whatever else. You did not feel this way.
No, it's not that I didn't feel this way. I didn't have. It wasn't going to be for me. It was going to be a talk about. Hey, you know, and we talk about this on the social all the time, like, can husband and wife work together? Would you work with your spouse? When you had that reaction, though, I thought to myself, wait a minute, she does have a point, because there is evidence to support your case. We've seen it with Most recently, the biggest example is Angelina Jolie directed Brad Pitt in By the Sea. And, well, we know what happened there. Sam Mendes directed Kate Winslet when they were still married in Revolutionary Road with Leonardo DiCaprio. Did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Did you like it?
I didn't hate it. I did like it.
I didn't hate it either.
Yeah.
It felt like a real marriage, real marriage that was hard.
Okay, but this is the problem. I feel like you're gearing up for a real list, and I don't want to interrupt, but this is what the issue is, I think, this is why it's extra weird. 95% of the time, if you're playing a couple in a movie, unless it's like some tween movie called like Middle School, it's because the marriage is going to go through some kind of rift or change or whatever. And the same realness that these two actors or an actor and director bring to it that makes it so amazing for us to watch means they're bringing their shit from home. I feel it's a heavy thing. Actors are already asking their spouses to go along with a lot. Oh, I got to kiss people. It's my job. I remember Sarah Jessica Parker talking about how delicious it was that she just had to be a smoker for Sex and the City. Oops, nothing I can do. There's already a lot that your spouse sort of goes along with if you're this person. And to kind of watch as everybody else in the room watches you have an intense moment or a marital discussion or something, I'm sure they talk with their therapist of how to separate it, but I think it's weird. Or I think it can bring up more things more often. And I said to you, I worry constantly about my loves, Matthew Rhys and Keri Russell, who did it kind of the opposite way, played spouses on TV, and then discovered, holy shit, we're super in love, and now they're together. And I want the Americans to go on forever, but I also want it to end so they can save their relationship. But there's an elephant in the room here, which is you work with your spouse, so?
And there were definitely boundaries, right? Like for, I think, 7 years, Jacek and I wasn't living in Toronto where I left the house every morning at 6 o'clock and was gone for sometimes up to 12 hours. So there was that separation. When we started the blog in Vancouver, for all intents and purposes, we worked out of the same 1,100 square foot apartment for days and days and days and days. But the rule was I wrote in one office and he wouldn't talk to me. Like, he was not allowed to, like, come in and be like, I just read this. There was no talking.
Mm-hmm.
It was not unusual for me to wake up and start writing at whatever time. And for he and I not to have our first exchange until maybe 5 or 6 hours later.
Right. And that is something that I buy, not only because of the nature of the business, but because I know you. But I don't know that you can do that on a movie set.
Of course you can't.
And day in and week out and month in and month out, and there's a lot of pressure and there's a lot of money. So am I overlooking some positive here? I mean, part of it is intuition, right? If you intuitively have chemistry with somebody, you have chemistry. God forbid you don't have it on screen. Have we ever seen that? Has there ever been a couple who kind of got on screen and felt flat?
Like a real life couple.
Yeah.
And then we watch them on screen and we're like, I don't know what this is. Like, I don't see it. I mean, no example comes to mind right now. But I feel like at the same time.
Actually, I got one. When you're ready.
Who?
Rhys and Ryan.
But they fell in love on that movie. You're talking about Cruel Intentions.
Right. They fell in love on that movie. So you're right. It was not quite the same thing because they weren't a couple playing a couple.
And you could tell that they were falling in love.
Yes, you could definitely tell.
Oh my God. That's part of why so many people liked that movie. That was intense. Like, I knew that they were boning.
But you could also tell that they were not the same, that they were not simpatico. Even then, that they were not lined up, maybe.
He has a great quote. I can't quote it verbatim. But do you know that scene where he breaks up with her?
Yeah.
he said that that was so hard for him. And remember, they were like 21 at the time, right?
So
at 21, you feel things in a way with an intensity that, like, you look back at 41 and you're like, oh my God, I'm so dramatic.
They were barely legally drinking.
That's right. So in that scene, he has said that having to yell at her and be mean to her was so traumatic. Eye roll, like, you know, oh, teenager, or oh, young adult, you're so dramatic. But he said that it was so traumatic for him that he would leave the set and, like, have to throw up. Like, that was so emotionally grueling for him.
I was here for most of that quote because I really like that movie. I was really hanging on to the eye roll, but it just triggered.
I know. Anyway, so those two, yeah, I mean, they were, I don't know, like, an example of people who, oh, here's one. Here, how about this one?
Mm-hmm.
And this is going way back,
good.
Way back. One of my favorite movies to watch on TV when it comes on like, you know, TBS on Saturday afternoon.
A lot of preamble, you guys.
Overboard. Uh-huh. Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn.
Okay.
First of all, I love that movie.
Sure.
And they were together at the time that they
already
made that
together?
Movie. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Yeah. And, well, Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn are...
Sure. I mean,
Kurt Russell and Goldie Hawn.
That might be the exception that proves the rule. Or if you're me, after we talked about Cruel Intentions, of course I immediately thought about, say it with me, Sarah Michelle Gellar and Freddie Prinze Jr.
Right.
Still together.
Were they together for I Know What You Did?
I think that's where they met and fell in love, but they did later do a couple of Scooby-Doo movies and
right.
Lived to tell the tale. So... I'm partly joking, but we don't have a lot of examples of showmances, as they're called, that have stood the test of time.
We are not like old classic Hollywood movie experts. Like, I mean, is there an example of like I don't
what?
Know.
Like Debbie no. Reynolds and Eddie Fisher? No.
Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn.
Well, that was, they couldn't, am I thinking of the right one? They could, yell at me, guys. But no, that was, they couldn't be together because he was Catholic.
Right. So that added to their intrigue.
That was the deal back then.
How about Lauren Bacall and Bogart?
Maybe that's who I'm talking about.
No, you're right in that Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy, he was married.
That's right.
So their relationship existed scandalously, if you will. So they were never fully legitimately together. But yeah, what about Bogey and Bacall?
I mean, sure. I'm out of my depth here, but.
But that's not current. I mean, the current workspace is different. And also, I mean, if we're going back to our original example of John Krasinski and Emily Blunt, he's not just an actor in the film. He's directing and writing it. So he is... I mean, for all intents and purposes, he's her boss, not just her colleague.
Yeah, he's going to be in it all the time. And, you know, I work in, we both do, in a very untraditional environment. I love to read about work, and I love this blog, Ask a Manager. And I was laughing because they always talk about how spouses shouldn't work together or, you know, ideally not even for the same company, let alone the same department. And I was going, that's a rule that doesn't apply in entertainment ever. First of all, because you're always there. Where else are you going to meet somebody?
Yeah.
And second of all, because there's nobody who would go, well, I got two great producers, but they're married. I better break them up. Or two great actors or anything. So it does happen over and over again. But I don't know. It seems like there are flaws in the process. You know what I was thinking, though? You know, this does not seem to apply in music. In music, if you do a collaboration, that's a week, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, even if you went on tour together, it's your performance and his performance.
Yep.
And there's no pretending involved.
Yeah.
Or her performance. I don't mean to be heteronormative there. And you then go on with your life. I think musicians... can be co-married quite well. And maybe actors can be co-married quite well. I just thought of another one. Guys, all these couples that are happily married are from the WB. you know, there's Alison Hannigan and Alexis Denisoff, just to really A-list it for you. But I don't know whether you can be two A-list actors and taking on the writing and directing and headlining the movie with all that that entails. I mean, you get paid a shitload of money, but it's also very stressful. I don't know if it's good for you.
Does it help, given that, like, you are worried?
Yeah.
Because you like them.
I do.
Does it help that it's not going to be forever? That it is a limited amount of time?
Sure. It's not The Americans. It's not day in and day out for years. It's one movie. And they can set up their schedules such that they know what they're going off to do much later. Yes, with the small exception that as the writer and director, you're not done when the movie is done. Then, of course, he will sit in post for months and watch every little detail and wonder if her eyes flickered at somebody else in one moment and wonder why they don't have enough chemistry to make that one moment work in another scene and maybe go back for reshoots. And she's going, it's fine. I gave everything I could. And then, you know, it's very hard. You know, when your significant other criticizes something about you, it can feel very, it can cut deep or it can just be annoying as hell. And then think about the fact that they're not always commenting on your work, on your day-to-day work. If they were, that's a lot. That's all I'm saying. It's a lot.
My question to you is, if it were to be okay.
And look, I'm sure it will be. Me not be the arbiter of
doom. No, our discussion here, our debate here is on the work and whether or not you can cross the work and the personal at the same time and make it. What are the qualities that are required in order to set you up for success?
I would definitely say rules, like you discussed, boundaries and, you know, established things that that you do or in this case don't do. You know, I don't I'm in a very happy relationship, but we're not so regimented about, like, we have Friday date nights. Some people are. But I would say that if you were working together all day every day, I would almost eliminate those out of course. I would make a point that then those dates become for your friends, for your family, for anybody else, to kind of get away from each other. Because as much as we all say, like, oh, you know, evenings are for home time or not talking about work or whatever, when your work is your whole life, it's real easy to talk about work. And in fact, that's why we're here, because we want to talk about work all the time, right?
Yeah.
So I think that could be easier to avoid if you spent conscious time away from each other.
You know what my question was initially, too, when I read this in terms of, and this goes back to what are the qualities that you have to do or you have to make this work, is how honest can you be? Like, if you're Emily Blunt and your husband, and you are Emily Blunt, like, I would argue that Emily Blunt's profile and work steadiness is a little bit more intense than John Krasinski's.
I would agree with that. Well, I would agree on a couple of levels. Number one, yes, she's definitely higher profile. I don't know if I would say about work steadiness, because he's always got some thing.
Yeah, sure. Let me clarify. John Krasinski is within sort of the age range and range of the Jake Gyllenhaals, the Ryan Goslings, the Ryan Reynolds, so on and so forth, right? Mid-30s, approaching 40.
Yeah, no, I know what you're getting at. He's not as big a star.
No.
However, what I would clarify is he has that, is it called Q factor?
Q, yeah.
He's likable.
Q score.
He's hugely, hugely likable, right?
Sure, but don't know that people are rushing to the box office to buy a ticket to go see a John Krasinski movie.
I would argue that they probably are. He doesn't make a lot of them because he's sort of, he's one of these guys who made enough money, one thinks, from The Office and all the syndication, that he doesn't take a lot of movies. You know, Leatherheads and License to Wed. And
he took that really shitty art, like, I mean, that, okay, well, I don't know. Maybe I'll get in trouble now because it was about, like, SEAL teams or military. It was a military movie. Do you remember it? Let me just look it up right now.
All right. You look it up. I'm going to talk about all the like pleasure projects that he's been working on. He adapted the David Foster Wallace book, mm-hmm. Brief Interviews with Hideous Men. Mm-hmm. That's not a crowd pleaser. That's a tiny little indie movie.
Sure.
Remember we read that he was writing about a movie about the Chateau Marmont?
Yes.
That's a deep research heavy kind of thing. This is a guy who is a writer and a producer and a director first who happens to star in movies. I think he's been quite open about admiring one George Clooney in that way, that, you know, Clooney does not shift himself to star in things so much as produce. And I'm not suggesting that John Krasinski is George Clooney. I'm just saying I think that's the model he wants to follow.
I would agree with that. And yet the movie I was thinking of, mm-hmm. first of all, is a Michael Bay movie. That it was the 13 Hours, the Benghazi movie, the Soldiers of Benghazi movie, which was, I mean, if I get in trouble, so be it. Shitty movie. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, if you've got to make a quick paycheck, a Michael Bay movie is the way to do it.
Oh, my God. And didn't do well. Mm-hmm. But, okay, back to the original point. There's Emily Blunt and there's John Krasinski. We both agree that she's more high profile than he is.
Sure.
So John Krasinski comes to you.
But neither is she, like, A-list.
Okay.
Let's be real.
Okay. No, she's not like Scarlett Johansson.
Oh, here we are.
But I mean, she's doing Mary Poppins. Look, she's on the list.
She works all the time.
Yeah.
I always go by, does my dad know who she is? My dad's 70. He likes to watch like a late night program.
So does your dad know ScarJo more than Emily Blunt?
100%.
There you go.
There you go.
To go back to last week.
There you go. I'm just saying.
But I would say though that if you're Emily Blunt, you've got offers. Lots and lots of offers. You're on a list. In fact, you might be tops on many lists.
Absolutely.
Then your husband. Sorry, Anne.
She's making her way up those lists. I don't mean to imply that she's, suffering for work, but she's just a level down from ScarJo versus Jennifer Lawrence versus Natalie Portman.
Sure.
Great.
So you're Emily Blunt. And John Krasinski, your husband, comes to you and is like, I want to do this movie. I've written the screenplay. I'm going to direct it and I'm going to star in it. I really want you to be in it. And you, like, do you have a choice?
Oh, this is where you were saying,
yeah.
How honest do you be?
That's the work, right? Like, it's work and life. Like, to me, this is the guts of this story. Like, I'm going to assume that it's good because I want to believe that he does good work, but at the same time, her agreeing to it is not the reason I think it's good.
You're saying that, well, there's two ways around that.
You see what I mean.
Well, yeah, but I'm not sure which end you're getting at. There's the place where you're implying that she's doing it because you got to keep the marital peace, and lending your star power to your husband's
movie is a
thing to do.
Can you say no?
But
can you say, hey, your work is not good enough for me to work on?
Okay, no, you can't say that. No, you better right quick line up something else for, several weeks. But she's also big enough now that she could move a movie. Not always, but if they wanted her for Mary Poppins, for example. And you know if you're an actor, whether you just beat somebody else out for the role or whether it's yours to kind of do what you want with. And I don't know the answer in that case. But it's not like at a certain point, if they want you, it's not like she can say, oh gosh, I have all these other movies lined up, because you can move one or the other. You're in charge of your own schedule at that point a little bit.
It's icky.
Or, however, I wanted to talk about another possibility, which is, and not that I don't think this movie is good, I don't know how we're down this path, but there's also the possibility of loving somebody so much that you think everything they do is brilliant.
I agree with you. I think there's more examples of that. Now there's more examples of that, like Guy Ritchie and Madonna. It depends where you fall on that.
Oy,
like they made that movie that was The Shipwreck Swept Away.
Oh, man.
Right?
Remember? Yeah.
So I don't know who's, like, the
Whose
movie
was
that.
Yeah.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. that's an example.
Yeah.
Where you're blinded by it.
Absolutely.
And it happens, to go back to your point about music, it happens in music too. I mean, when Katy Perry and John Mayer were together and they did a song together, that song was terrible.
Yeah, but a song is so much more like,
yes, you can throw it away quicker. Yes.
When it works, hello, Bonnie and Clyde 03 or Crazy in Love, it's there. It's a testament to your chemistry. But when it doesn't, it's gone.
And it just came to me. Sarah's point about Melissa McCarthy working with her husband, Ben Falcone.
Yeah.
And her point is that, like, Ben Falcone's work that she's done a few times is not that good.
No, it's not. In fact, I had an Uber driver in LA who was not impressed with Melissa McCarthy's choices to add her husband into every project.
But there you go. I mean, isn't, to me, that would be the closest equivalent to John.
To what now? Whoa, that's a real...
The possibility is what I'm saying.
I'm just saying we're spending
a possibility.
We're spending a lot of time on a possibility that is unproven. I think this is going to be great.
Right. That's why you were worried about it at the beginning, but okay.
Not because it wasn't going to be a good project, but I think there are two different discussions here. I'm worried about a marriage. I'm not worried about a script. And I suspect that you are, and that is your prerogative.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
All right. Next, we are moving on to Stephen Colbert.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent you a story that came out in Vulture called How Stephen Colbert Got His Groove Back.
Right.
What jumped out at me in this article, because Stephen Colbert, since the Trump administration, since Donald Trump has become president, has been rising steadily in the ratings to the point where I think in some demos he's doing better than The Tonight Show and Jimmy Fallon. And the reason why this is remarkable is because he was shit. Like, it was, the ratings were not good, the buzz was not good, the show was awkward.
Yeah, it was shit. It was unfocused and weird, and
yeah.
It wasn't nailing things. It felt unsatisfying.
That's right. So this article in Vulture tracks how and why he got his groove back, how and why this surge happened. And in particular, this sentence in bold was the reason why I sent this to you, and you said that it was pornographic and almost had an orgasm.
That's true.
Right. The sentence is, quote, Colbert realized he needed to stop being a micromanager.
You're actually a little bit speechless.
I am a little speechless, just like you were orgasmic.
Yes. Hi, Mom. Let's break this down. Why? Why? Why are you so speechless? Why is it such an exciting thing to read?
It's a little bit aspirational. I'm a micromanager in the sense where I fixate, I want to do everything by myself.
I don't think you are at all, but I support that worldview. Go on.
It took me a long time. Like, and maybe you're seeing that now because I have let go of certain things, but there were many, many years where Jacek was like, hey, let's find a way to get this off your plate.
Right.
And it was hard.
Mm-hmm.
There were times when I needed to get back to every single query. I needed to look at every single thing.
Can we talk about that? That when I met you, you were like working your way through all the email that had ever been sent to you and emailing people back one by one. It's kind of amazing.
And listen, it's not something that I don't want to say that I enjoy not writing back to every single email because I do miss that. But there comes a point where there's only so much you can do and you have to delegate or select and prioritize.
And it makes your work better. I think that's why, to me, it was so exciting in all the ways, right? Because so much of the time, what keeps people from figuring out that they should relinquish some control is this idea that they would be better at it than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
An expression I'm guilty of using myself is, it's quicker to do it than it would be to explain it to somebody, which is absolutely true, but still bullshit. It will still make it better because the mental energy that you're using on whatever mundane task it is or whatever mundane task Colbert was focusing on can be used to be Colbert. And I think that's a really exciting thing to hear because when you're as wealthy and successful as he is, a lot of people just don't see that. A lot of people don't process those kinds of pieces of work feedback. You're not doing as well as you could. You could be doing better. That's kind of rare.
Mm-hmm. It's rare, too, to go back to something you just said 30 seconds ago, to say, I think that I'm the best person to do this thing. And when he is admitting that he doesn't have to micromanage, it's also acknowledging that the people whose job it is to do certain things are actually the best people to do those jobs. That's why they're there.
You know, we often talk about people who are generous, people who get a win, who win an award or who have some success and who pass it around or don't. And I think this is also to do with that. If you're generous about letting people do their jobs, then it really does feel like all your wins and it's enough to go around. You know, I have a friend who is a very, very successful executive. And I watched her get a compliment from a higher up about a project that had been delivered via her team. And she sent back an email to a whole bunch of executives saying, oh, thank you. The work was done by this low-level person. And of course, the low-level person was walking on air for a week. And my friend, the executive, looks great because she looks like she chose somebody great to do it. It takes nothing away from her to give that compliment to somebody. And the execs go, well, oh, well, look at her. She's got things in hand. A lot of people don't do that. A lot of people keep the credit for themselves, keep the success for themselves. And that's the other thing, right? The sort of flip side of, oh, I can do it all myself is, and if it succeeds, it's all me. I did it all myself.
What I like most about the story you just told about the executive who you know is that the actual exact quote of giving credit is, it doesn't cost me anything. And it's a quote that I have gone back to a lot in my mind about what things cost. And what she was saying is, hey, by me letting others know who I feel is responsible for this win, it doesn't take anything away from me, but I think that a lot of people have that fear that if you share credit or give credit, somehow it diminishes you.
And this can happen a lot earlier in your work life, right? When you finally get a little bit of responsibility or a kind of high-profile project, you really want to show how well you did. I remember something that I did once, and there were several of us who got sort of a high-profile assignment. And I kind of looked askance at people who were asking for help at every turn. I'm like, I don't need help. Guess whose projects were better? The people who asked for the help. I didn't ask for help because I was so sure, not even so sure, but so determined to prove I could do it myself. It doesn't look as good.
No. I do want to also say that the reason why this bolded line about micromanaging and letting go resonated with me in particular this week is because I've been reading a book after meeting an author on the social. He and his wife came on the social. His name is Stephen Marsh. He wrote a book with his wife, Sarah Fulford, called The Unmade Bed. So just a quick recap, Stephen Marsh and Sarah Fulford lived in New York. He was a professor on track to be tenured. And he ended up giving up all of that to move back to Toronto with her because she was offered a job as the editor-in-chief of Toronto Life magazine. So basically he, a man, gave up his career so that his wife could pursue hers. And there were many reasons for it, but when he got back to Toronto and became the primary household manager, looking after their children, looking after the household chores, he talks about how he was judged by some people, including his dad, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you go get all that education if you're just not going to use it and just stay home with the kids? And, you know, his book, The Unmade Bed, really is about the changing dynamics between men and women in their roles at home and professionally. And there is one thing that he says that really, really hit home for me and for a lot of women that I talked to afterwards. And he talked about how women are pursuing their careers these days and they're getting home and they're like, even if they have a supportive male partner who is the CEO of the household and is stacking the dishes or doing the laundry, they'll get home and they'll be like, I have to redo the dishwasher because I don't want the dishes to be stacked this way, or, you know, I want it cleaned this way. And his quote is, housework is the macho bullshit of women.
Whoa, that's a good quote.
And what he was saying is, at a certain point, ladies, I am here, and there are many dudes, I'm married to one of them, who are here for you, who will be the CEO of the home, but you can't go to be the CEO of your professional lives and then come home and be like, but I want the laundry folded this way and we need to clean it this way. At a certain point, you have to let go of that.
Right. Let somebody do it.
Yes.
And let them own it.
But many women, and we talk about this, this is called emotional labor, the thank you cards, you know, making sure that the gifts are all bought for the cousins and the whatever and the right gifts so that you're not judged, because the judgment always comes back to the woman. At a certain point, you have to let go of it.
It's really interesting because it's
his
not,
argument.
His argument. I have been wanting to read that book. Actually, I'm gonna take it out of here tonight. But it's really interesting because what you're pointing out in relation to this quote is that, you know, it takes nothing. There's no macho bullshit about Colbert saying, "I can't do it all. I'm not
yes.
for everybody," which is really nice.
Yes.
And it makes me think of, speaking of macho bullshit, it makes me think of the environments of comedy and whether they are, in fact, the sort of male-based macho comedy rooms or not, as we're often told. I saw this quote from Noelle Wells recently, and it really surprised me, and I sent it to you. And I don't know if it gave you the same sense of panic. So Noelle Wells was on SNL for, I believe, one season. She was, you know, she did okay in terms of airtime. And then she left SNL after one season when her contract was not renewed. And then, of course, she went on to play the love interest in Master of None. And now she has a new movie that she just had at, I believe it's Sundance, Mr. Roosevelt. But the quote that was interesting here was that she talked about how she didn't miss SNL because it was a comedy establishment, so everyone would naturally want its stamp of approval. But she says she and other people who didn't spend much time on the show are much stronger doing their own thing without having to try and impress comedy dinosaurs. And she also said, oh, SNL is, it's become what it was always trying to make fun of. So, you know, it was one of those things. What do you make of this quote? Because, or collection of quotes, I should say, because that is fairly assembled and each article is it's a bit assembled in terms of putting these quotes together. You know, she says, for whatever reason, we got rejected, meaning she and I believe Brooks Whelan and John Milheiser were the other freshmen who were cut that year. But that's okay. It's exactly more rock and roll. I had a very distinct reaction, but what was your reaction to this quote?
And You know, and you included Brooks and somebody else.
John Millhiser.
Yeah. And then there's also Jenny Slate. Mm-hmm. Michaela Watkins, I think, is in there.
Well, you're getting to the point of the matter here. Yeah. John Millhiser and Brooks Whelan were the two first-timers who were cut the same year as Noelle Wells after
right.
only 1 year. But you're getting to a much finer point here. Go on.
No, I don't know if I'm getting to the thing that you're telling me to get to.
I'm not. Go get to your point.
Listen, at first, my reaction was, oh, I appreciate this candor.
Right.
Like, I love the honesty.
Mm-hmm.
And then it kicked in, and I started thinking, and I was like, is this smart?
Mm-hmm.
Is this savvy?
Mm-hmm.
And is it necessary? You went on, and you were on Aziz Ansari's show. As you mentioned, she's doing some films. What we talked about, what things cost you when they don't cost you anything. What is the benefit of calling Saturday Night Live a bunch of dinosaurs and a machine that you no longer we want to be a part of, and it's, you know, besides the point? Is there a benefit? I don't know. I'm asking you.
So I'm going to tell you what I think. What it sounds like, even though, as I said, she mentions those two dudes that she was cut with, you know, or at the same time as, you bring up Jenny Slate and Michaela Watkins.
And I think it says Casey Wilson is also in here.
Oh, yeah. Casey
yeah.
Wilson. These are all women who spent a short time on SNL. And, you know, SNL had, I'm going to put that D on the end there, SNL had this sort of big female renaissance in the last couple of years. Ady Bryant and Kate McKinnon and Cecily Strong and Sasheer Zamata and Leslie Jones and Vanessa Bayer. And for a while, it felt like, oh my God, this is this great powerhouse of a time for women on this show. And I would say that that has, I don't want to say it's lessened, but I think the show's really strong right now, and there's a whole cottage industry of people who just, like, watch SNL like it's baseball, like, just handicap it and go up and down. I will talk SNL with you anytime. I will talk about Colin Jost. But there has been an argument leveled, and not just here, that sometimes the reason that women seem to be sidelined in environments like SNL or, you know, a Second City or other sort of comedy venues, either stand-up comedy or, you know, sitcoms or whatnot, is not because they're not funny or not because they're not doing it right. Or, you know, we talked a couple of weeks ago about all these women who were not in the room at Late Night with David Letterman. But because the people who are judging what is funny are men. Often white men who are seeing things through their filter, and they don't see the value in what they don't see. You know, the only person who has sort of talked about this in a way that implies real breakthrough success is Tina Fey, who talked all the time about how she more or less would just yell at the men until they got the point of what she was saying and that it was super funny. And, you know, there are a lot of reasons why Tina Fey is Tina Fey, but she sounds so completely unintimidated, and I think sort of got a lot of comedic things through that might otherwise not have. Mom Jeans is one of them, and they talked about Kotex Classic. I remember her referencing in her book. All this to say, I think she did it because she just sort of looked at people like they were idiots. But there's an accusation being leveled here in not the most articulate terms.
Right.
Not unlike my ramble right here. That the reason it didn't work out for Noelle Wells or some others at SNL is because they're not open to what women or certain types of women or some women find funny. Discuss.
If that is the argument that she was trying to make,
mm-hmm.
I think it was a little bit too obscure.
Okay. I mean, what if it was the other argument? The other way to read this is they're old and I'm young and I'm funnier. And I'm paraphrasing a lot. And there's cockiness there. But is it too obscure if it's that argument? Because you really seem to bristle about comedy dinosaurs.
I bristle about comedy dinosaurs and I bristle about the machine. I bristle about the quote that is, why are we all trying to be accepted by all these comedy dinosaurs? SNL has become what it was always trying to make fun of. It's become this big machine. I don't want to be plugged into a big machine. So there is definitely what you're arguing, as in these are white dudes who determine what white guys find funny. And then there's another argument about it's big box comedy. It's the Walmart of comedy. But to me, if you want to go in and you want to be like, we were young women, we had a point of view that was funny, but you white dudes just didn't think that there was an audience for it, and your male-centric point of view, especially comedic point of view, blinded you from seeing that there could be a space for that, I'm down. But this to me, you either get specific or you don't get anything. You don't get anywhere at all.
So just to be specific about the specific, you mean get specific about your quote?
Yeah.
Because as you're talking, I'm hearing another argument that says, you know, because she talks here about being watered down. There are arguments from both sides of things that sometimes what is funny is the super specific. And I would argue that some of the funniest sketches on SNL are the most specific. Le Jeune dans Paris is inexplicable and hilarious because it's inexplicable.
It's adorable. Like, I love it.
But, you know, big box comedy, as you put it, is a different argument. It's also, I would argue, to your point, it's not a big enough deal to talk about.
Yeah. What is, to me, tell me what exactly you were trying to say and criticize.
So if she was Kate McKinnon, would this be a different story? Is it okay to say that if you're a huge, massive star?
But Kate McKinnon's not saying that. She didn't leave.
I'm just wondering if it, I'm wondering if we're also passing this through the filter of, you know, who you are. If this were Sasheer Zamata, who we have discussed on this podcast before, who you do have to care about, and she discussed the reasons why she felt like, you know, her time on SNL was like this instead of like that, is it a different quote? Would we care more if it were a bolder name?
I would care more if, to me, it was 100% that Noelle was making a statement and knocking it out of there and was having this ha 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 moment. Do I feel like Noelle has had her ha 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 moment yet? She was good on Master of None, but am I looking at Noelle and saying, fuck, she made Master of None? I mean, fuck yeah. In the same way that, oh my God, people are like, wow, yeah, Gabby Hoffman on Girls.
Mm-hmm.
You went, oh wow, yeah, I can't picture it without Alana Glazer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you. That's what I mean. She's not.
Sorry. And I feel very conflicted saying this because my go-to, my inclination is to always be like, what is this woman trying to say? I want to support her. But I just don't know if, number one, it's clear enough here, if it's pointed enough here, and whether or not it's warranted. Sometimes things just aren't for you. Maybe they're too big box. Maybe they're not specific enough.
Ultimately, I agree with you. I think this was not a big enough deal to warrant this question, and I should point out that it was asked at, not at Sundance, but at South by Southwest, is where this quote came from. But I think it's interesting that it made so many headlines, because it's not making headlines because of her movie. It's making headlines because people want to run something about SNL, but as you accurately point out, there's not a lot to say.
Right now.
There's not a lot in that quote.
There's also, if we want to really get specific and pinpoint it, this happened when Noelle Wells was on the show. She was on the show in 2013. And in 2013, that was also when Kate McKinnon began to bubble.
Oh, yeah. That was the rise of all the women.
And you mentioned Cecily Strong.
And Aidy Bryant.
Vanessa Bayer. So if the argument is it's not a place for women and they don't get the female comedy, I just gave you four names. And these are the four names that, as you said, have become the heart and the beating soul of the show.
that's a different conversation for another time. But they certainly have had various moments in the sun. But we should move on.
I just mentioned Gabby Hoffman in Girls. We promised last week that we would talk about Girls.
Yeah.
Would you call it the twist?
Yeah, it's a Hannah. It's a big plot bomb.
Right.
Yeah.
But specifically, the reason why you have been thinking about this and I started thinking about this is because, 3 weeks ago, there was an article, again in Vulture. Vulture, you're doing great work. We love reading you. And this article in Vulture, March 6th, was the pregnancy plot, how TV shows use motherhood to force characters to grow up.
So, spoilers ahead. Hannah has discovered that she's pregnant and is certainly leaning towards keeping it. I don't find this to be so untoward on Girls, which has been a show about being resolutely childish for many years, for a long time. I mean, that was the criticism leveled at it in the beginning. That was sort of the MO of the characters. And so I kind of understand from a story point of view why the writers thought it would be interesting to take Hannah to this place. The article is really interesting because it kind of highlights a lot of really iconic career-focused women who suddenly become more well-rounded, more grown up once they have a baby. And listen to these names. Murphy Brown, Miranda on Sex and the City, Mindy Lahiri on The Mindy Project, Rachel on Friends, or as I will always say it, Rachel off Friends. Thank you, Ricky Gervais. It's really interesting when you start to look at it that way. Characters who did not come onto the scene as mothers, as parents, who were arguably, in all of those cases, quite fulfilled with their lives already. In the case of Miranda and the case of Murphy Brown, they were resolutely single and comfortable with it. Your mileage may vary where Sex and the City is concerned. It's really interesting. And it, once I sort of read it and sort of thought about that in that way, it left a bit of a taste in my mouth. There's also a line in the show just before Hannah discovers that she's pregnant. A woman talks about how the ideal state for a female writer is to be childless. And I also read a quote years ago, please don't ask me where, that says, and you'll love this, every child a woman has is a book she does not write.
Oh, oh.
Ask me whether that was said by a man or a woman.
I don't have to.
Exactly. So, weeks later, this article is still staying with us.
It is still staying with us. I haven't caught up, so I've been spoiled, but I care less about the shock than I do about how they treat it. And what stood out to me in this piece was that their concern is that this particular storyline, which is, as they say, a life-altering occasion, comes so late in the series so that they don't get to see how Hannah will manage.
I mean, I guess to me, that's an interesting argument, but I guess to me, it's not the point. Maybe in all those other shows that we listed, the idea of becoming a parent once the strip turns pink is an eventuality. This show is not that. The second episode of the show threw a party at an abortion that never wound up happening, but there is every possibility that if Hannah decides not to become a parent, that our life would continue apace. So I'm less interested in, I suppose, you know, how would she change her life? Because I think we know. I think we know that she would, you know, rely on her parents and get an enormous stipend and bit by bit figure it out. And it would not be some revolutionary change, but incremental. You're giving me a face. You don't buy it.
I don't buy it. And okay. I don't buy it because I agree with the premise of this article, and I'm going to quote, you know, fiction is quite practiced at showing us the shock of a positive pregnancy test and the hysteria of dramatic birth later, but it's much less practiced at telling stories about what it would actually be like to write while also mothering. That's what I want to see. And maybe that's just me, because so many writers I know do it while mothering.
Sure.
And they do it very well. And they do it in contrast to that stupid-ass quote that you just gave from the man who said how many books have been lost with how many children women have had. And so, to me, I agree with this point, that this happening at this point in the show, does that mean I'm not going to get to see Hannah being a mother and yet managing to write a book? Three books. Five books.
Here's the problem.
Zadie Smith has written two books since becoming a mother.
Sure she has. Sure. And people do. Let's be real here. J.K. Rowling wrote many a book with children. People write books with children.
Maybe it's not cinematic. Is that the problem?
That's the problem. Writing is already one of the biggest bullshits of television and film, because everybody likes a character who's a writer, but watching somebody write is very boring. Watching them come up with ideas maybe is exciting. And, you know, watching them parent is, let's be honest, it's cute for a minute, but there's not a lot to say. One of the examples that they cite of somebody who is a mother, a writer, and a character that we see is Jane on Jane the Virgin, which is another show I deeply enjoy. But that show plays with tone and form all the time. We get to see how her writing can be exciting because they literally have the narrator narrate it. We see the scenes get acted out. And they do make a huge point, even on that show, of the fact that baby Mateo is left with half a dozen adoring caregivers at any given time. There's a rich amount of family around. So there's no struggle there. It's not necessarily exciting. And look, I'll just say it. As somebody who writes things and parents someone, it looks very boring. It looks like getting up in the morning in sweats and drinking cold coffee and tapping things out for a little bit and then getting up and going on with your day.
I guess that's why. I mean, I understand, because I do understand what is considered cinematic and what you can shoot and what you can visualize versus actually to real people what is sexy. Like when you say you do write and you do parent, fuck, Duanna, as we've talked about many times before and I've said to other people and to you, that is fucking sexy to me. It's sexy as hell to me when I see a text from you at 2 o'clock in the morning, because I know that you set your alarm to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, because that is those 3-4 hours of, you know, from 2 to 6 is when you get to write, when your son is sleeping. And maybe it's very specific in terms of who this is interesting to, but at the same time, I just don't know that those visuals are what we get to see out there.
You're right. And so the challenge might be how to make them cinematic. Because I guarantee you, if that was happening on the show, you'd be like, I'm bored. If we were watching, you know, people struggle with money, it's never sexy. No matter how poor people
sure.
are, it's never fun to watch
I get
on
that.
Screen.
I get that. And I agree. I work in TV. I understand what is considered boring and what people want to watch. But I'm just saying that when we talk about a diversity and a realism in storytelling and what storytelling can do in terms of reflecting social norms and social acceptance, my God, would it be sexy if somehow someone could be imaginative enough to be able to write what it looks like when a writer is a mother.
Put your money where your mouth is. I'm giving you homework. It is not to have a baby. Your homework is to come up with what you'd like that scene to be. You can write it if you want to, or just tell me. You guys do it too. Send us your idea of what you'd like to see. The idea of a mother who's balancing work. And of course, not just writing. Any work that is meaningful and not necessarily has the ability to be done in an office. Because I think we know how people are mothers and nurses. And the answer is, we've seen a little bit of how that might work. You don't tend to nurse with a baby on your hip. But send us your ideas. I will take this on as well. Let's see if we can come up with a way to make this work be shown in a way that is exciting and cinematic and that you would want to watch as well as want to see proven. Other thing that I have to point out, not to aggrandize anybody, I'm not a single parent, lest anybody think that that's the case. I am a co-parent. That is much easier, first of all, and much different than the characters that we're talking about, who actually almost to a fault are single parents. So there is some glamour to be examined on screen there, but I don't want anybody to have the illusion that I'm just casually doing all this by myself, because I ain't.
And finally, we come to our, I don't know, is it becoming a regular feature that we end on? Do we need to care about?
Yeah.
So this week's Do We Need to Care About is my pitch, and that is Yara Shahidi.
So this is what's funny about this segment, is that it's becoming the place where one of us is trying to talk the other into having to care, and you guys come along for the ride. And I have to say, it really lights up the inbox.
So I understand that perhaps my affection for Yara Shahidi is enhanced because she's on basically my favorite show on television, and you hear me talk about it all the time, and that's Black-ish.
Right.
So Yara Shahidi plays the oldest child of Dre and Bo, Anthony Anderson, and Tracee Ellis Ross. Her name is Zoe. Yara Shahidi has become a fashion star. She shows up on the lifestyle section of Lainey Gossip all the time.
That rainbow dress. Is that the Golden Globes?
My God. I can't remember right now where it's from, but fashion star. She is, they are kind of sort of trying to see if they can do a Denise Huxtable style spinoff for her from Black-ish to when Zoe goes to college.
So that's a big deal. Like, there are a lot of shows with a lot of people on them, and they don't get spinoffs. Like, remember when Modern Family was, like, up in everybody's nostrils all the time?
Yeah.
And you knew all of those kids whether you wanted to or not?
Yeah.
They didn't get spinoffs.
Nobody was talking about a Sarah Hyland spinoff.
In fact,
were they?
No. in fact, I can't remember the last time there was a spinoff, period. When they work, but they're hard to do. Like, The Originals was a spinoff of The Vampire Diaries.
Yeah.
Here I go again with the 90s and
oh, there's the Breaking Bad spinoff.
Yeah.
Better Call Saul
was a spinoff of Breaking Bad. And Angel was a spinoff of Buffy, to take it really back a bit.
Is The Good Life a spinoff of The Good Wife?
It is, in fact. It is, in fact, a spinoff of The Good Wife. I've not seen The Good Life yet. I'm saving it up to collect all my Diane.
But
all
characters
at once.
Don't get spun off as often, and certainly I don't feel like female characters do.
Well, and in most of those cases that we just talked about, the series was over. You know, in the case of Better Call Saul,
you're right.
In the case of The Good Life, it's sort of, well, we're done here.
Yeah.
So let's kind of go off over into this, we're done here and let's see another angle of this world.
100%. It was not concurrent.
No. The Denise Huxtable and A Different World
were concurrent.
It was concurrent, and it was really, it was kind of groundbreaking in terms of, let's see a different side of this world. Let's see, a different side of this person's life outside of this living room.
That's right.
And with the full understanding that she's still part of the family. And that's what the idea is for Zoe, right? That she's still part of the family, that she's still going to appear on Black-ish.
Yeah.
She's not leaving the show. Cut to those headlines in a few months, by the way. Please, people, write proper headlines. Like, do your research and don't get caught in the clickbait. However.
However, the reason why I'm pitching this is because That actually came out a few weeks ago or a couple months ago that Zoe might be getting a spinoff. The reason why I'm pitching this is because it came out this week that Yara Shahidi has applied to college. She's of the age. And that one of her letters of recommendation came from Michelle Obama. And first of all,
I mean, like, that's stacking the deck.
Like, first of all, who's not going to accept her? And okay, and period, the end. But the reason why this was so interesting to me and so exciting to me is because there has been talk, some talk of her deferring for a year because maybe said spinoff, because she's kind of taking, like, you know, strike while the iron's hot. Is that the expression?
Yeah.
So her work is building up right now. Her work, there's buzz around her. So does she go to school? Does she take a year off? And I don't feel like we've had one of these stories since Emma Watson, right? Emma Watson finished Harry Potter and then she went to Brown and had a thing at Oxford. And before Emma Watson, there were the Natalie Portmans and the Jodie Fosters of the world who very famously, when they're very, very famous, decided to, hey, I'm just going to put acting on hold and I'm going to go to school. I want to do the school thing. I think Jodie went to Yale.
Sure.
Right? And Portman went to Harvard.
Portman went to Harvard, absolutely. But, you know, Emma Watson and working backwards, those are people who said, yeah, I'm going to put it on hold. We talked earlier about being powerful enough that stuff will wait for you. Natalie Portman's movies will wait for her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Emma Watson, God, anything that Emma Watson wanted would wait for her at that point. And if something passes you by, well, something else is going to come along that's going to be even better. The thing with Yara Shahidi is I don't know if she's there yet. I don't know if, you know, this is the fear of every young actress, right? If she goes away for a while, will people bother to miss her? You will.
I'll miss her. And as a part B to that, you don't know if she's there yet, but she's also a Black actress.
Yep.
And we already know that there are limited opportunities. It's getting better, but let's not kid ourselves. It is not even close to being there.
Right.
So we already know that there are limited opportunities for Black actors. And since she is building, since it is snowballing, and she happens to be of a certain type, for lack of a better word, that doesn't get on the top of the list, that they don't write for yet, that they don't consider at the top, you know, let me get Emma Stone, let me get whatever. Is this smart?
But she's closer than ever, right? Like, this is why there's a debate. Because the kind of argument on the one hand is always, you know, school is important. School is expanding your brain. I come down 93% on that side. The other argument on the other side when they ask somebody who turns 18 is, oh, are you going to go to school? And they say, but you know what? School will be there and this opportunity won't be, and so forth. And this is what you're talking about when you talk about her. Sure, she is a Black actress and not somebody who is, yeah, she's not Emma Stone. She's not even, you know, Miley Cyrus at 18. She's not even getting those roles. What she is, though, as we just talked about, is a familiar face. A fashion darling. People love a fashion darling. It's real good for sales. And she's kind of got the world as her oyster. So it becomes a real balancing act. I know nothing about her parents or her management team, which is a plus. The less I know about your parents or management team, the more I'm into who you are. Millie Bobby Brown. But it would be a hard decision to make if I were them.
Yeah. And this is why I wanted to talk to you about her. I feel like that is just at the intersection of all we've talked about in terms of opportunity and work and age. We've talked about young stars before. She just turned 17.
Like, let's be honest. And that's young to go to school anyway. So, you know, deferring is certainly something that could be on the table.
It's definitely an option.
It can be done. Remember those great giant summer breaks?
Mm-hmm.
In university, like, they were long.
Yeah, you were done by second week of April.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's everything to suggest that she could fit in a project, even two, between the second week of April and the third week of August or whenever it is you go back. There's no reason that her career has to stop for 4 years. And there's a good month at Christmas, too, depending on who you are. I don't know. I don't know what I would choose. I'll tell you what I wish. I wish there was some other project on deck. Her IMDb right now has some of the projects she's done. She is the voice of something animated, I believe. I wish there was one more thing to hang on to have people sort of have an appetite for. And maybe that's coming and we just don't know about it yet. But I'd really like to see what's the next thing and the non-Blackish thing, not because I think the spinoff won't be great, but because if you're going to turn into something, you want people to associate you with you and not just, oh, one of the kids from Blackish.
I care about Yara Shahidi. I want everybody else to care about Yara Shahidi.
I want to care. Let's put it that way.
Great. I win. That's it for us. Thank you for listening. Thank you for caring about work. Thank you for writing to us about work.
Yeah.
My God, your work emails are amazing. Please keep sending them to us.
Please keep working. Please keep grinding away when you feel like you don't know what you're doing or why it's happening. It is all for the good.
Check us out on iTunes and Google Play, and we'll be back next week. Work hard.
See you later.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.